Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, April 11th, and this is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. I am Jeff Dunphy, and I welcome you. I greet you from Calgary, Alberta. I trust that we will continue along the lines of entertaining you and filling you with some modicum of approach to the great ancient wisdoms. And we will chat today of the keys to the ancient wisdom. And we will also chat about how we best inform and teach people how this ancient wisdom serves them in this time that we are in the throes of seeing unfold. Now let's chat a little about the ancient keys, and then I want to dive into the seven postulates that Helena Blavatsky brought us in the great book, The Secret Doctrine, in the late 1800s. I think it was published in and around in about 1875. Now, first, I want to chat about the keys to the ancient wisdom and how and why they may seem relevant and why we might pay attention to them. The first key, I'm sure these are modestly list of importance, but the first key is the astrological key. And in this, we speak to not so much the horoscopes that we see in the world today and in the newspapers today, but in how the planets affect us and how we are connected to the world in a very big way, connected to the stars, connected to the sun, the moon, the planets. Our solar system is vital to us, and it affects us in everything we do. The esoteric aspect of this is that our astrology has been, I'm not sure kidnapped is the right place, but perhaps brought on a wee bit of a detour. And we talk about astrology these days as exoteric or mundane. And the true astrology that was given us in Egypt tens of thousands of years ago. And consequently, the Egyptian predisposition towards astrology was that which was hidden and used by the priests in order to facilitate various things. This would have been called the esoteric. And the other side of that would be the exoteric, and that was what was shared with the populace, the general populace, the non-initiates, if you will. And the exoteric, or mundane, as we will make reference to it, this is the astrology that you go to figure out whether it's a good day to go shopping. We are wont to call this mundane astrology. And this is the astrology that, by its design, rules the personality. Now, the personality is the lower vessel. It is the automobile, if you will. It's the lower vessel of our soul. Our soul resides in what we would call our causal body. This is the two triads, the causal body, from the vernacular of the church, would be the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. However, from the esoteric science and the ancient wisdom, way before the Catholic Church pitched up, we would have the Atma, Buddhi, and Manasic realms, in which this would be our higher triad. The lower triad is our physical, our emotional, and our intellectual bodies, if you will, or realms, or levels, or aspects. And your personality is defined by your physical, your emotional, and your intellectual predispositions. Astrology will, in the next 10 to 15 years, become incredibly validated. Historically, it has always been thought of very highly and always been revered for its capacity to give insight into who you are. And its development, and it will establish itself as a legitimate science in this next age, in this next time period. I've been told, and I've read, and I've seen, and I suspect very highly that its legitimacy is imminent. Now, it begs, as do many of the ancient keys, the ancient wisdom keys, it begs answers to the question, who am I? And we'll play that hand. And we have a guy named René Descartes, many years ago in the late 1400s, coined the phrase, I think I've said this before, but we'll just digress for a few moments. He coined the phrase, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And consequently, this has been taken a bit too literally. And in fact, merely because we think doesn't necessarily make us who we are, because if you can learn how to extricate yourself from identification with your thoughts, or if you can learn how to quiet your thoughts, you become subject to the true query, and that is, when you stop thinking, do you stop being? Do you cease to exist? There's a bit of a philosophical wrench in the gears for you. So instead of cogito ergo sum, Latin for, as I said, I think, therefore I am, it should have been coined, or as esotericists, we might choose to coin it, sum et cogito, I am and I think. So we revisit the ancient teachings, and we revisit the keys, and the astrological key is something that I know is in the throes of being validated, and it's something that I spend considerable time and energy studying and reviewing and seeing how it may and can and will shed light on people and their purpose effectively. The esoteric astrology is less involved with the personality predisposition and more involved with the soul, or the calling, or the genius, as we would call this in engineering school, the genius in you. And consequently, we may in later programs chat a little about astrology. I likened it to a friend the other day who was a graduate with a degree in music. I likened it to the planets have an effect on you when you're born, when you enter into this realm, much like being born into the chord being played on a piano, and all of the chord and how the various notes in the chord on the piano are resonating and have thirds and fifths and octaves and have a whole bunch of interaction with them. And you were born into this chord that is being played on a piano. And she found that to be very demonstrative of something that she could understand. So the astrological key is but one. The next is called the astronomical key. Now this brings to light a program that is currently being revivified, if you will. Carl Sagan's program called The Cosmos is now being done by a guy named Neil deGrasse Tyson. And he is a brilliantly well-spoken individual. And you can see him, and you can see a brief vignette on Bill Moyer's website. And he has the new series called Cosmos. And his predisposition, he is an astrophysicist, and his predisposition is the astronomical aspect of what's going on. Now, one of the things he brought to bear and brought to light the other day on Bill Moyer's show was the universe, the known cosmos that they can see, is acting in ways that demonstrates to them, because they can measure these ways, demonstrates to them that the cosmos and the universe around us is accelerating. Now, we have spoken of the law of acceleration for some time, but let us speak a little further to why we know, as esotericists, why we know that the universe is expanding and accelerating, and why the conventional esotericists view it as they see that it is accelerating, but they cannot explain it. Now, one of the things that I'm not sure, perhaps a phone call might be in order to ring this guy, but one of the things that I know that astronomers tend not to give credit to, and that is the various other bodies that these planets have. Now, when we spoke of our own bodies, the personality, which resides in the physical, the emotional, and the mental, it is fair to say, if we use the law of correspondence, that a planet has a physical body, has an astral body, or a mental or an emotional body, and has a mental body. So consequently, one of the things that I don't believe the astronomers are giving credit to or have yet to validate, and that is they know the physical aspect and attributes of these various planets, but they are want to know or want to discover the emotional and the mental attributes of these planets. And it is through those bodies which have yet to be, which are not measurable using their current methodology and have yet to be really discovered or validated, and it is those other bodies that are creating this very act of acceleration. This is called dark matter. And I suspect as time moves on, we will have scientists that will play with that and start to investigate with eyes unclouded by their predecessors and eyes unclouded by convention. You know, as one of my teachers was wont to say often, and that was the dogma of tomorrow is the heresy of today. And when we make reference to these odd and peculiar things, I suspect that in a relatively short period of time, these things will be taken as truths. Now, I want to read something to you about truths. It's called Three Great Truths, and it was written by a wonderful woman who was very wisely and graciously directed from the higher realms, from the sages, and her name was Mabel Collins. It was like this. "Hear me, my brother," he said. "There are three truths which are absolute and which cannot be lost, but yet may remain silent for lack of speech. The soul of man is immortal, and its future is the future of a thing whose growth and splendor has no limit. The principle which gives life dwells in us and without us, is undying and eternally beneficent, is not heard or seen or smelt, but is perceived by the man who desires perception. Each man is his absolute own lawgiver, the dispenser of glory or gloom to himself, the decreer of his life, his reward, his punishment. These truths, which are as great as his life itself, are as simple as the simplest mind of man. Feed the hungry with them." Now, this has been handed down throughout the ages and is one of those brilliantly simple declaration of truths that we trust humanity will be waking up to as this time unfolds and as the scenario unfolds. Now, last week, we spoke of the planetary changes to the Earth and to ourselves and to the nations. We spoke of economic and political conflagration, if you will. And we spoke of a potential war, and in fact, a potential world war. But today, we're going to chat about how we can retool and how we can see things through different eyes. That brings me to another little thing that a writer named D.H. Lawrence wrote some time ago. And one of the reasons we study ancient teachings, because we in the esoteric realm know that the knowledge and the brilliance of the ancients was in fact far more advanced than what we think. And it is because we know and understand the law of periodicity, and that would be civilizations evolve and their evolution is they grow and they peak and they become very high and they fall and they involute and they fall again and they fall away from knowing. And all of the civilizations have in fact done that. Their apotheosis comes and goes. Their peak comes and goes. And so when we study them, we're studying them anew, but we're studying them with conventional predisposition towards them. We now are a little more conversant and have eyes to see and ears to hear what they had to say. Generally, when people are receptive to a message, their capacity to hear it, understand it, and heed it, if you will, is very high. However, as many of you will resonate with, there are things you can tell somebody that if their receptivity index is non-existent, it will make no difference to them whatsoever. So speaking of it or telling to them or preaching to them, if you will, is akin to casting pearls before swine. So now let's chat a little about D.H. Lawrence and what he offered in one of his observations. I honestly think that the great pagan world, of which Egypt and Greece were the last living terms, had a vast and perhaps perfect science in terms of life. I believe that this great science was universal, established all over the then existing globe. I believe it was esoteric, invested in a large priesthood, just as mathematics and mechanics and physics are defined and expounded in the same way in the universities of China or Bolivia or London or Moscow today. So it seems to me, in the great world previous to ours, a great science and cosmology were taught esoterically in all countries of the globe, Asia, Polynesia, America, Atlantis, and Europe. This is simple theosophy. Now, as we know, the great sage, the great lama, as some will want to say, Helena Blavatsky, was the one. She and Henry Steele Olcott, they founded the Theosophical Society, and it still exists today, although I suspect it is merely a shell of its former self. I think it has spawned various others as well. Now, I want to read you another little quote here because I think it speaks to furthering what we're going to talk about today, and it has to do with the ancient keys to the ancient wisdom. And think what it means if God to you is no longer a name, but a life. That is the glory of the mystic. That is the joy of the one who knows. Wherever you go, you see him shining. You look at the wonder of nature spreading out before you, and in the whole of that manifested beauty, as is the tiniest fragment, you see it all irradiated by the perfect beauty that is God. You see him in the blue of the sky or ocean. You hear him singing in every bird. You see him smiling in every flower. And most of all, you see him in the heart and in the intellect and in the love of men. You see him in the righteousness of the most holy, and you see him hiding in the heart of the basest, illuminating it now and then with some touch of human love, which is the nearest of all things to God, whose very nature is love and bliss. So Annie Besant wrote that, again, many years ago, probably in the early 1900s, maybe even in the late 1800s. Now back to the ancient keys, if we might. So we've covered the astrological and the astronomical. The next is the physiological key. Now, why would we study our physiology? Why would we study our bodies? Well, in keeping with the ancient teachings, and keeping with the law of correspondence, we remember that what is above is as below, and what is below is as above. So, if we study the body with an esoteric perspective, we do get and understand that the body is a reflection of something of a bigger order, of a higher order. And so we have the physiological key is studying the body. And some would say, certainly the ancients would say, that the human body is a solar system in the macrocosm. And the solar system is a physical body in the microcosm. We had the evolution of yoga that transpired over the last several civilizations. And we have the evolution of the civilizations in how they progress from less evolved to more evolved. Or as some would say, they fall out of connection. They fall into the more dense, the more mundane, the quagmire that we are all in now. And as we start to, that's the involutionary time. And as we reach the bottom of that process, we become the most dense, and we now tend to into the evolutionary time, where we become lighter and more aware. This is the path of return, some have spoken about. Now, the yoga and yogis and the Indian tradition that comes from the Himalayas, comes from Tibet, they taught eons ago yoga that reflected and respectfully honored the place where mankind was over the time. So in our first physical iteration of a civilization, we would call these the Lemurians. The leftover of the Lemurians, by the way, in these days, are the Zulus. Now, that was the third civilization, the Lemurians, the first physical physicists. And the yoga that they were indulging in order to perfect their connection with and their harmonization with the physical body, this was called Hatha yoga. The next civilization was called the Atlantean civilization, and now we start to progress upwards, and that is the physical is Hatha yoga, the Lemurians. The next is the emotional or astral, and this would be the Atlanteans. And the yoga that the Atlanteans used for the emotion, the perfection and the honoring of the emotion was called Bhakti yoga. And the civilization that we are now in, we call the Aryan civilization, not Hitler Aryan, but the Aryan civilization of which the fifth root race effectively reflects. And the yoga for this is the Raja yoga. And an offshoot or an aspect of Raja yoga is Kriya yoga, which is given us by the great yogi, Paramahansa Yogananda, who worked his magic and his way in the early 1900s. And the end of all yoga is immortality that was given to us by a friend and fellow aspirant named T. Savaro, a friend of ours. Okay, the physiological key. There we go. We've got a bit of a debrief on that. The next key would be the metaphysical key. Now, metaphysics is outside of the physical, and it is understanding how the influence of the other realms affect the physical. So as we see the esoteric science, we delve into the higher realms of the physical and the corresponding aspects of the physical, which will be the astral and the mental and the manasic, which is the higher mental, and the buddhic and the atmic, which are the realms even higher still, the seven realms, the seven sheaths. Now the metaphysical key speaks to the way that things reflect above and beyond the physical. The next key is called the anthropological key. Now, anthropogenesis is the root or is part of an aspect of that. And anthropo would be, we would call this man. And genesis is the beginning of man. And understanding where and whence we came and understanding how various approaches to figure out where we came from, where do we come from, have been at best incomplete. And at worst have led us into a blind alley that gives us modest misperceptions about where we come from. The next key we call the geometrical key, which is a great sage in our history, Pythagoras, coined the phrase that God geometrizes. Now there is a certain brilliant aspect of the geometric perfection of Mother Nature. And certainly the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians were masters of understanding how Mother Nature has a perfection of geometric brilliance that they manifested in their buildings, in their symbols, in their art, in their sacred geometry. And they allowed it to and built it so that mankind could be witness to it and learn from it. The mystical key is the next. Well, the mystical key is the attribute of the mystic, and that is the knowing and understanding and respectfully and divinely directing the cosmic laws in order to further the evolution of our planet in a way aligned with the light, if you will, or aligned with enlightened pursuits. Key we call the numerical key. And this was another aspect that Pythagoras brought us many years ago, and it is the brilliant philosophy of numerology. Now, somebody coined, or I read somewhere, that numerology was to arithmetic what psychology was to anatomy. And I think there is a certain aspect of numerology that will gain more and more validity as time unfolds, and the true embrace and the true esoteric understanding of numerology, numbers, and how and what they represent and how they manifest in Mother Nature in this brilliant world in which we live, will again go from ignored or ignorance to revered and honored. And the last key, and equally as important as all the others, is called the symbolic key. Now, symbolism, the art of symbolism, the majesty of symbolism, the esoteric nature of symbolism is something that for those with eyes untrained is lost on many. And the symbols and the symbolism and the brilliance of symbols is omnipresent on the planet. It has been used by all of the sages in the past, and it is the very manner and methodology which our higher selves, our geniuses, our soul, if you will, communicates with our lower selves, with our personality. Now, the retooling, as we get back to it from time to time, the retooling is identifying and recognizing who and what your personality is and how to align it in such a fashion that it becomes a perfect instrument in the hand of your genius. Or as in some writings would say, allow me to be a perfect instrument in the hand of God. Now, as we align our personality, as we synthesize and integrate our soul into our personality, we become divinely directed. And the key of symbolism and the symbolic realm that we do learn to engage in and indulge in is learning what the symbols mean. Now, one of a very famous psychologist named Carl Jung wandered us through how important symbolism was and certainly did an enormous amount of writing and spoke of the collective unconscious. And it is through our esoteric pursuits that we plug into this so that it may be of service to us. However, we also recognize and understand that if we are in conversant in the realm of symbology, how is it that we can expect to understand the symbols? How is it that we can expect to understand the language by which our genius which wishes to communicate to us? And so consequently, the symbolic key is that venue or avenue where we study symbols to understand what they mean so that when our genius pitches up and shows us, because the genius or the soul or the higher self communicates with symbols, it communicates in images. We are conversant in the images so we understand where it is that it's coming and what it is meaning for us to get out of the symbol. Now, there's a phrase called, a picture is worth a thousand words, and it comes to us because it is very, very true. And that aspect of the study of symbology will, as time unfolds, become more and more and more valid and more imperative to the effective evolution of mankind. How is it that we retool? Let me revisit a couple of aspects of our evolution. And then I want to chat a little about what the ancients gave us in terms of the seven postulates. Something that's quite important is the reference to conventional Christianity as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, the reference to conventional spirituality in Hinduism or in Buddhism might be Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva. So we have various attributes of the Holy Trinity, and we also would meld these into the three rays of aspect, and that would be ray one, which is love, wisdom. Or ray one is, sorry, willpower. Ray two is love, wisdom. And ray three is active intelligence. Now, part of that falls into the another redefine or another definition or another phrase by which we may coin them is in knowledge, love, and sacrifice. And the knowledge petals, the love petals, and the sacrifice petals are these petals that unfold so that we can find and discover the jewel in the lotus. This is a incredibly ancient phrase, and it is has been given us, it was given us eons and eons ago, the opening of the jewel in the lotus. Now, the knowledge petals are gained by study of the occult classics, by focus and attention, by self-remembrance, who am I, by ray analysis, by understanding the rays and how they benefit, how our knowledge of them benefits us in learning who we are. Now, the love petals are facilitated and further illuminated via discrimination, self-identification, identifying self, higher self and lower self, visualization, meditation, and a word called in-stress. And in-stress is the path of those who wish to retool, the path of those who wish to wake up, is a stressful path. And it is how to deal with those stressors in a way that they augment your search. They serve as a springboard in order for your evolution to present itself. And the sacrifice petals. These present themselves in service to mankind. Learning how to control your breath, which is a conscious and conscientious modality of managing your parasympathetic nervous system. And this is a function of initiation. There's a bit of food for thought, isn't there? This is, as you have gleaned by now undoubtedly, more of an esoteric approach and less of a exoteric approach of how Mother Earth is dealing. We ebb and flow, and there are times when we chat about Mother Earth and how things are falling into place, and there are times when we indulge ourselves in the introspective journey. Now, there are seven postulates of ancient wisdom, which were written down and given to us in a book called The Secret Doctrine by Helena Blavatsky. And these are basic to progress in the study of the occult in any sort. So further, these postulates, as you become more familiar with them, must be lived if the life of the student is to take on the aspiration to retool, is to take on the path of a spiritual unfoldment, a higher self unfoldment, to recognize that the physical is not only who you are. The knowing of who you are presents itself in a higher place. So the first postulate, and we may not actually get to cover all the postulates depending on how much of a chatter I am, but let us indulge. The first postulate speaks to hylozoism, and it is the proposition that all things, organic or inorganic, are filled with life, from the tiniest atom to the greatest galaxy. Now, that is something that used to be unacceptable by the scientists of the day. And consequently, when we say that all things organic or inorganic are filled with life from the tiniest atom to the greatest galaxy, this is something that is not self-evident by merely viewing the physical. And we don't merely view the physical in our esoteric pursuits. There is one boundless, immutable principle which lies behind all manifestation of form, and that is life. Nothing exists outside or beyond this one life. Even energy itself, in its subtle and most abstract forms is a manifestation of this life. Now, hylo comes from the Greek word for matter, and zoism means life. So the theory propounds that everything lives, from the tiniest to the grandest. So Helena Blavatsky's proposition came at a time when science was only just beginning to reject the concept that the basic elements were made up of tiny balls of their respective substance, atoms, a concept which dated back, as far as we could tell given the writings at the time, 500 years back BC to Democritus. The possibility that atoms could contain life, or worse, some degree of sentiency or consciousness, seemed absolutely absurd then, and the proposition hardly changed for another 25 centuries. So it's just taken us now with the quantum physicists of today. Gary Zukav wrote a wonderful book called The Dancing Woolly Masters, and it speaks about where conventional quantum physicists have come now, recognizing that the great ether in and of and around things ties everything together, and there is no disconnect, and there is life and consciousness in everything. That atoms may be alive may still seem to the scientists a very foolish speculation, but there are signs that the scientific community is starting to come around to various things. The barriers are creaking, as it were. Now, that premise was put forward by Aristotle as well, and by Plato, and by Socrates. And it's far more acceptable to scientists today. Our nature has made such a gradual transition from the non-living to the living that the boundary is doubtful and probably non-existent. We're starting to come to that conclusion, which is lovely things, lovely things. Now, the second postulate is all things live within the body of a greater being. Now, this is obvious when it's pointed out, but is completely impossible to see until somebody points it out to you. Now, the premise behind this, obviously, is that all things live within the body of a greater being, and it's lost on most people until they are told how to view it, okay? So hylozoism, which was the first postulate, doesn't stop at the atom, nor does it stop at man. It proposes that atoms live within greater forms than themselves. Atoms live within the body of a molecule, for instance. Living molecules sometimes form part of the body of a greater being, which is the tissue cell or the unicellular organism. And many cells come together to form greater structures like man himself. Each entity, no matter how large or how small, is alive and lives within the body of a greater being somewhere along the scale of evolution. So does man live within the body of a greater being? Well, the ancients teach us that man is no exception to any of this. We have created a sociological predisposition towards man that he is out of the forces of Mother Nature, that he has spent all these eons combating Mother Nature and overcoming Mother Nature and battling Mother Nature to become the victor over Mother Nature rather than living in harmony with Mother Nature. It's a very interesting and desperately egocentric approach to how these things happen, which, again, baffles those great sages of the past. So does man live within the body of a greater being? And the wisdom of the ages would propose that he is no exception, and that man lives within that sentient and great entity, which we've called and made reference to, a root race, and at the center of which is a Manu. And going even further, the root races themselves are not only sensitive living entities, but they form but part of the body of that great living entity, which we would call humanity. Our fifth root race, which we call the Aryan root race, whose outward form is so well known to us who compose it, is inwardly a living center of etheric force in humanity, a center which corresponds to our own throat chakra. The Atlantean race that I made reference to earlier That was the fourth. Corresponds to the solar plexus center in that distinguished being. And in the same way, the remnants of Lemuria corresponds to the sacral center. For even in him, within whom we live and move and have our being, there is an evolution of consciousness. And his is drawing away from his sacral and solar plexus, and is shifting into that of the throat, hence the upsurgence of the fifth root race. Now, talk to this to a conventional scientist, and they may laugh at you, and that's their prerogative. However, as the phrase said, oftentimes the pioneers are the ones with the most arrows in their back. But it also behooves us to recognize that when we think a little bit outside of the box, in an unconventional way, great things will be revealed to us if our receptivity index is high enough. So we can wait patiently until that day when it will be intuited by the great masses that even the planets of our solar system and even those of other solar systems are, but the outward expression of great lives and so on and so on and so on, up to the greatest galaxies themselves. Our Milky Way, which is the galaxy in which we live, is alive and sentient and has an evolving consciousness governed by the great same laws of being, which rule ourselves and, back to the old adage, back to the tiniest atoms. For centuries, our own solar system has been given the esoteric name of the Grand Man of the Heavens. And yet, even he is but the heart center within the body of a far greater being that even the highest initiate can only dimly comprehend. And it is no wonder that he is referred to as the one about whom naught may be said, which is a lovely phrase. And as one of my students is wont to say, we haven't the capacity to comprehend it, so hardly worth troubling yourself with trying to figure it out. So you will have noticed that we've arrived almost at a consideration of the universal. And that is essentially the occult method, the esoteric method. And that is to study the universal as a preliminary to the consideration of the particular, which in this instance is to be man. We are trying to understand something of a stupendous consciousness of those great beings in whom we live before attempting to evolve a psychological formula for ourselves. And as I said before, the ancient keys to the keys to the ancient wisdom that we just wandered through, these are the manner, the methodology, and the tools to rediscover who we are. Interesting. Interesting food for thought. So now let me play a bit with the law of correspondence now, because I want to chat a little about as above, so below, and as below, so above. And let's chat a little of, again, we'll just dive in. So the being of that great entity referred to, the one about whom naught may be said, is comprised of seven solar systems. We have a propensity of sevens in our reality, which we will revisit when we work a little on Hermetic philosophy. And one of these is our solar system and is the embodied force of the heart center within this great entity. Heart represents love. All you need is love, as the Beatles were inspired to sing. And there is an overshadowing of the ray of love wisdom, which is the second ray, on this solar system. So owing to his position as the heart center within this being, our solar logos transmit the heart quality that we call love to all of the planets within the system, which is just what I said. Descending in scale to our own planet Earth, the three chief centers in the life of our own planetary ruler, or our own logos, are the head center, which we would call Shambhala, which is willpower, will and power. The heart center, which is the hierarchy, and this is the love. And the throat center, which is humanity, which corresponds to active intelligence or the mentality. And herein, it is the heart center, the hierarchy, which receives the great logoic impulse of love and transmits it to Earth. There are great sages floating around there and are transmitting the brilliant aspect and energy and honorable flow of love towards humanity. And coming down in the scale, still a little further to man, the individual, we see him as a tiny reflection in each of the above. And he also has his seven centers, just like we have the seven planets, we have our seven centers or chakras in our system. And in our time, it is the heart center in man, which is of the supreme importance. For effectively, it is this heart quality of love, which at its best leads man to his highest. This is the bridge between the lower centers and the higher centers. Now that is a pretty big second postulate. So as we evolve away from thinking, our egocentricity, as we move toward understanding that we do move and live and have our being in something bigger, whether it's community, whether it's a country, whether it's a hemisphere, whether it's a civilization, whether it's all of humanity, it recognizes the phrase that we use often and should be used often and it should be coined and kept close to heart, and that is, as go we, so go I. This whole concept that you are an island is erroneous. It's delusional, and it's very harmful to the healing of the planet, to the evolution of the planet, and certainly to the effective saving of the planet. As we leave one type, one age, which is the Piscean age, and we're entering a new age, the Aquarian age, we're leaving the age of belief. And we're now starting to step into the age of knowing. And this is where the young individuals these days who are very advanced souls and very conscious and conscientious, there is an aspect in them that is no longer happy to just believe. And they have moved inward and upward along the evolutionary scale, and their aspiration is to know. Implicit in this postulate three, that the soul of an entity is the consciousness of the one in which it lives and moves and has its being. And this needs careful thought and noodling. Noodling and brooding, as one of my teachers says. Few esotericists have any sort of idea as to the nature and purpose of the soul and why, for instance, the soul of one man is said to be the same soul as another. However, the unit of consciousness ensouling the whole of mankind and something even bigger than that, again, is the entity, is the consciousness of the one in which it lives and moves and has its being. There's some big ones. And it is as we destroy our sense of separateness that we become conscious of that greater being. We become conscious of the earth, of the world. This great soul that is wandering around right now in the form of Eckhart Tolle, who has been writing books called The Power of Now. One of his great simple references is when things get a little crazy, go and wander around in Mother Nature. What great simple advice to connect you with the being in whom you move and live and have your being. And that is why meditation, or any manner by which you learn how to extricate yourself from your identification with your thoughts and also from your identification with being separate, is a brilliant process and something that will serve you well always. Because in meditation, we are sharing the higher and the more majestic energies and qualities, which are the part of the life of that great being in whom we move and live and have our being. So that's a little about postulate two. And now we're going to challenge postulate three, and perhaps we play the game, the law of correspondence, in Ray 1, 2, and 3, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva. So postulate 3 comes to us as all things are made in the image of God. Now in life, the same life fills all things. It will tend to display similar qualities in the various forms that it activates. Now when you view things through eyes, through physical eyes, you see that there's a myriad of ways that it can manifest itself. However, when you view it through esoterically trained eyes, you do recognize that all things do have a similarity that is quite remarkable. So many of the characteristics obey the few physical laws that we've begun to understand in our various labs, but many do not. For instance, as temperature rises, a system tends to become less organized. But where life is involved, it tends to demand an increase in temperature, as in the egg, for its effect to be wrought. Life seems to have discrete areas of activity which are part of the ring pass knot of an organism, the realm in which it resides, and the realm in which it is stuck in, if you will, the ring pass knot. And all within it seems to be attracted by forces which is, can only be described as magnetic, or, as we move further up, electromagnetic. And changes in the form seem to be initiated from within through those esoteric observers would call an etheric matrix. So we integrate with and we are connected with higher realms. And now that, as we talked about earlier, the physical is not just where we reside. It is an expression of realms that happen from above. So the organization of the form is maintained through a main center or nucleus into which energy is pulsating through what the Sanskrit would call sutratmas, or threads from higher dimensions. So just as the higher realms give direction and guidance and connectivity to the lower realms, it happens on every level. So these qualities of life are true for an atom, a man, a planet, and a solar system. As above, so below. And every one of these life patterns lies within what we call an auric egg. And indeed, as the occult classics and the ancient teachings suggest, then much can be gained through the study of the unfolding embryo and what is observed thereby may very well be applicable fundamentally to every one of those things, the atom, the man, the planet, and the solar system. And it is out of this that arises the third postulate. All things are made in the image of God. Light within darkness, sound in silence, the hub within the wheel, the nucleus within the atom, the sperm within the ovum, the nucleus within the cell, man within his aura, a planet within its field, and a sun within its solar system. Wow, big food for thought. This is just the first three. There is something in symbology, which we chatted about, ancient keys, and the wisdom of the ages also indicates that the point within the circle has its own plan and structure, which would be the nucleus within the atom and the nucleus within the cell and the sperm within the ovum, all of that, right? The archetypical pattern of the point is shown later, as we will talk about, in the ultimate physical particle, which we would call the Anu. Pretty heavy and big and deep and thick stuff. However, we will carry on with this direction the next time we meet. And with that, I would like to thank you very much for your attention, for your grace in listening and for allowing me to be of service in sharing that which was given us by the ancients to pass along and to disseminate in as understandable a manner as we may. Thank you for allowing us to help you retool for your coming of age.